Now it really was dawn, the cusp of the day that belonged to no one except the seagulls in Moorpork Docks, the tide that rolled in up the river, and a warm, turnwise wind that added a smell of spring to the complex odour of the city. Death sat on a bollard looking out to sea. He had decided to stop being drunk. It made his head ache. He tried fishing, dancing, gambling, and drink, allegedly four of life's greatest pleasures, and wasn't sure that he saw the point. Food he was happy with. Death liked a good meal as much as anyone else. He couldn't think of any other pleasures of the flesh, or rather he could, but they were, well, fleshy, and he couldn't see how it would be possible to go about them without some major bodily restructuring, which he wasn't going to contemplate. Besides, humans seemed to leave off doing them as they grew older, so presumably they couldn't be that attractive. Death began to feel that he wouldn't understand people as long as he lived. The sun made the cobbles steam, and Death felt the faintest tingling of that little springtime urge that can send 1,000 tons of sap pumping through 50 feet of timber in a forest. The seagulls swooped and dived around him. A one-eyed cat, down to its 8th life and its last ear, emerged from its lair in a heap of abandoned fish boxes, stretched, yawned, and rubbed itself against his legs. The breeze cutting through Ankh's famous smell brought a hint of spices and fresh bread. Death was bewildered. He couldn't fight it. He was actually feeling glad to be alive, and very reluctant to be deaf.
"I must be sickening for something," he thought.
Mort eased himself up the ladder alongside Isabel. It was shaky, but seemed to be safe. At least the height didn't bother him. Everything below was just blackness. Some of Albert's earlier volumes were very nearly falling apart. He reached out for one at random, feeling the ladder tremble underneath them as he did so, brought it back and opened it somewhere in the middle.
"Move the candle this way," he said.
"Can you read it?"
"Sort of."
"Turnered his hand, but was sorely vexed that all the men at last come to naught, viz. Deathy, and vowed him to seek immortality in his pride. Thus, he told the young wizards, we may take unto ourselves the mantle of goddies, the next day it being raining. Alberto."
"It's written in old," he said, "before they invented spelling. Let's have a look at the latest one."
It was Albert, all right. Mort caught several references to fried bread.
"Let's have a look at what he's doing now," said Isabel.
"You think we should? It's a bit like spying."
"So what? Scared?"
"All right."
He flicked through until he came to the unfilled pages, and then turned back until he found the story of Albert's life, crawling across the page at surprising speed, considering it was the middle of the night. Most biographers didn't have much to say about sleep, unless the dreams were particularly vivid.
"Hold the candle properly, will you? I don't want to get grease on his life."
"Why not? He likes grease."
"Stop giggling, you'll have us both off. Now, look at this bit."
"He crept through the dusty darkness of the stack,"
Isabel read,
"his eyes fixed on the tiny glow of candlelight high above. Prying, he thought, poking away at things that shouldn't concern them, the little devils.
Mort, he's...
Shut up, I'm reading.
Soon put a stop to this. Albert crept silently to the foot of the ladder, spat on his hands, and got ready to push. The master'd never know he was acting strange these days, and it was all that lad's fault, and..."
Mort looked up into Isabel's horrified eyes. Then the girl took the book out of Mort's hand, held it at arm's length while her gaze remained fixed woodenly on his, and let it go. Mort watched her lips move, and then realised that he, too, was counting under his breath. 3, 4. There was a dull thump and a muffled cry, and silence.
"You think you've killed him?" said Mort, after a while.
"What, here?
Anyway, I didn't notice any better ideas coming from you."
"No, but he is an old man, after all."
"No, he's not," said Isabel sharply, starting down the ladder.
2,000 years? Not a day over 67. The book said, I told you time doesn't apply here, not real time. Don't you listen, boy?"
"Mort," said Mort,
"and stop treading on my fingers. I'm going as fast as I can."
"Sorry."
"And don't act so wet. Have you any idea how boring it is living here?"
"Probably not," said Mort, adding with genuine longing, I've heard about boredom, but I've never had a chance to try it.
It's dreadful.
If it comes to that, excitement isn't all it's cracked up to be. Anything's got to be better than this.
There was a groan from below, and then a stream of swear words. Isabel peered into the gloom.
Obviously I didn't damage his cursing muscles, she said. I don't think I ought to listen to words like that. It could be bad for my moral fibre.
They found Albert slumped against the foot of the bookshelf, muttering and holding his arm.
"There's no need to make that kind of fuss," said Isabel briskly. "You're not hurt. Father simply doesn't allow that kind of thing to happen."
"What did you have to go and do that for?" he moaned. "I didn't mean any harm." "You were going to push us off," said Mort, trying to help him up.
"I read it. I'm surprised you didn't use magic."
Albert glared at him.
"Oh, so you found out, have you?" he said quietly.
"Then much good may it do you. You've no right to go prying."
He struggled to his feet, shook off Mort's hand, and stumbled back along the hushed shelves.
"No, wait," said Mort. "I need your help."
"Well, of course," said Albert over his shoulder. "It stands to reason, doesn't it? You thought I'll just go and pry into someone's private life, and then I'll drop it on him, and then I'll ask him to help me."
"I only wanted to find out if you were really you," said Mort, running after him.
"I am. Everyone is.
But if you don't help me, something terrible would happen. There's this princess, and she..."
"Terrible things happen all the time, boy."
"Mort!
And no one expects me to do anything about it."
"But you were the greatest."
Albert stopped for a moment, but he did not look round.
"Was the greatest. Was the greatest. And don't you try and butter me up. I ain't butterable."
"They've got statues to you and everything," said Mort, trying not to yawn.
"More fool them, then."
Albert reached the foot of the steps into the library proper, stamped up them, and stood outlined against the candlelight from the library.
"You mean you won't help?" said Mort. "Not even if you can?"
"Give the boy a prize," growled Albert, "and it's no good thinking you can appeal to my better nature under this here crusty exterior," he added, "'cause my interior's pretty damn crusty, too."
They heard him cross the library floor, as though he had a grudge against it, and slam the door behind him.
"Well," said Mort, uncertainly.
"Well, what did you expect?" snapped Isabel. "He doesn't care for anyone much except Father."
"It's just that I thought someone like him would help if I explained it properly," said Mort.
He zagged. The rush of energy that had propelled him through the long night had evaporated, filling his mind with lead.
"You know, he was a famous wizard."
"That doesn't mean anything. Wizards aren't necessarily nice."
"Do not meddle in the affairs of wizards, because a refusal often offends," I read somewhere.
Isabel stepped closer to Mort and peered at him with some concern.
"You look like something left on a plate," she said.
Okay, said Mort, walking heavily up the steps and into the scratching shadows of the library.
"You're not. You could do with a good night's sleep, my lad."
"Mort," murmured Mort.
He felt Isabel slip his arm over her shoulder. The walls were moving gently, even the sound of his own voice was coming from a long way off, and he dimly felt how nice it would be to stretch out on a nice stone slab and sleep forever. Death'd be back soon, he told himself, feeling his unprotesting body being helped along the corridors. There was nothing for it. He'd have to tell Death. He wasn't such a bad old stick. Death would help. All he needed to do was explain things, and then he could stop all this worrying and go to sleep.
"And what was your previous position?"
"I beg your pardon?"
"What did you do for a living?"
said the thin young man behind the desk. The figure opposite him shifted uneasily.
"I ushered souls into the next world. I was the grave of all hope. I was the ultimate reality. I was the assassin against whom no lock would hold."
"Yes, point taken, but do you have any particular skills?"
Death thought about it.
"I suppose a certain amount of expertise with agricultural implements," he ventured after a while.
The young man shook his head firmly.
"No."
"And this is a city, Mr.
He glanced down and once again felt a faint unease that he couldn't quite put his finger on.
"Mr. And we're a bit short of fields."
He laid down his pen and gave the kind of smile that suggested he'd learned it from a book. Ankh Morpork wasn't advanced enough to possess an employment exchange. People took jobs because their fathers made room for them, or because their natural talent found an opening, or by word of mouth. But there was a call for servants and menial workers, and with the commercial sections of the city beginning to boom, the thin young man, a Mr. Leona Keeble, had invented the profession of job broker and was, right at this moment, finding it difficult.
"My dear Mr. He glanced down. "Mr. We get many people coming into this city from outside because, alas, they believe life is richer here. Excuse me for saying so, but you seem to me to be a gentleman down on his luck. I would have thought you would have preferred something rather more refined than..."
He glanced down again and frowned.
"Something nice working with cats or flowers."
"I'm sorry. I felt it was time for a change."
"Can you play a musical instrument?"
"No."
"Can you do carpentry?"
"I do not know. I have never tried."
Death stared at his feet. He was beginning to feel deeply embarrassed. Keeble shuffled the paper on his desk and sighed.
"I can walk through walls,"
Death volunteered, aware that the conversation had reached an impasse. Keeble looked up brightly.
"I'd like to see that," he said. "That could be quite a qualification."
"Right."
Death pushed his chair back and stalked confidently towards the nearest wall.
"Ouch."
Keeble watched expectantly.
"Go on, then," he said.
This is an ordinary wall, is it?"
"I assume so. I'm not an expert."
"It seems to be presenting me with some difficulty."
"So it would appear."
"What do you call the feeling of being very small and hot?"
Keeble twiddled his pencil.
"Pygmy?"
"Begins with an M."
"Embarrassing?"
"Yes," said Death. "I mean, yes."
"It would seem that you have no useful skill or talent whatsoever," he said. "Have you thought of going into teaching?"
Death's face was a mask of terror. Well, it was always a mask of terror, but this time he meant it to be.
"You see," said Keeble kindly, putting down his pen and steepling his hands together, "it's very seldom I ever have to find a new career for an, what was it again?"
"Anthropomorphic personification."
"Oh, yes. Well, what is that exactly?"
Death had had enough.
"This," he said.
For a moment, just for a moment, Mr. Keeble saw him clearly. His face went nearly as pale as Death's own. His hands jerked convulsively. His heart gave a stutter. Death watched him with mild interest, then drew an hourglass from the depths of his robe and held it up to the light and examined it critically.
"Settle down," he said. "You've got a good few years yet." "I could tell you how many, if you like."
Keeble, fighting to breathe, managed to shake his head.
"Do you want me to get you a glass of water, then?"
The shop bell jangled. Keeble's eyes rolled. Death decided that he owed the man something. He shouldn't be allowed to lose custom, which was clearly something humans valued dearly. He pushed aside the bead curtain and stalked into the outer shop, where a small fat woman, looking rather like an angry cottage loaf, was hammering on the counter with a haddock.
"It's about that kook's job up at the university," she said. "You told me it was a good position, and it's a disgrace up there. The tricks them students play, and I demand. I want you to. I am not..."
Her voice trailed off.
"Here,"
she said, but you could tell her heart wasn't in it.
"You are not Keeble, are you?"
Death stared at her. He'd never before experienced an unsatisfied customer. He was at a loss. Finally, he gave up.
"Begone, you black and midnight hag," he said.
The cook's small eyes narrowed.
"Who are you calling a midnight bag?"
she said accusingly, and hit the counter with the fish again.
"Look at this," she said. "Last night it was my bed warmer. In the morning it's a fish. I ask you."
"May all the demons of hell rend your living spirit if you don't get out of the shop this minute,"
Death tried.
"I don't know about that, but what about my bed warmer? It's no place for a respectable woman up there. They tried to..."
"If you would care to go away," said Death desperately, "I will give you some money."
"How much?"
said the cook, with a speed that would have outdistanced a striking rattlesnake and given Lightning a nasty shock. Death pulled out his coin bag and tipped a heap of verdigrised and darkened coins on the counter. She regarded them with deep suspicion. "Now, leave upon the instant," said Death, and added, "before the searing winds of infinity scorch thy worthless carcass."
"My husband will be told about this," said the cook darkly, as she left the shop.
It seemed to Death that no threat of his could possibly be as dire. He stalked back through the curtains. Keeble, still slumped in his chair, gave a kind of strangled gurgle.
"It was true," he said. "I thought you were a nightmare."
"I could take offence at that," said Death.
"You really are Death?"
said Keeble.
"Yes."
"Why didn't you say?"
"People usually prefer me not to."
Keeble scrabbled among his papers, giggling hysterically.
"You want to do something else?" he said. "Tooth Fairy? Water Sprite? Sandman?"
"Do not be foolish. I simply feel I want a change."
Keeble's frantic rustling at last turned up the paper he'd been searching for. He gave a maniacal laugh and thrust it into Death's hands. Death read it.
"This is a job? People are paid to do this?"
"Yes, yes. Go and see him. You're just the right type. Only, don't tell him I sent you."
Binky moved at a hard gallop across the night, the disc unrolling far below his hooves. Now Mort found that the sword could reach out further than he had thought. It could reach the stars themselves, and he swung it across the deeps of space and into the heart of a yellow dwarf which went nova most satisfactorily. He stood in the saddle and whirled the blade around his head, laughing as the blue flame fanned across the sky, leaving a trail of darkness and embers. And didn't stop. Mort struggled as the sword cut through the horizon, grinding down the mountains, drying up the seas, turning green forests into punk and ashes. He heard voices behind him and the brief screams of friends and relatives as he turned desperately. Dust storms whirled from the dead earth as he fought to release his own grip, but the sword burned icy cold in his hand, dragging him on in a dance that would not end until there was nothing left alive. And that time came, and Mort stood alone except for Death, who said, "A fine job, boy." And Mort said,
"Mort!"
"Mort, Mort, wake up." Mort surfaced slowly like a corpse in a pond. He fought against it, clinging to his pillow and the horrors of sleep, but someone was tugging urgently at his ear.
"Hmm?"
he said.
"Mort!"
"What is it?"
"Mort,
it's Father."
He opened his eyes and stared up blankly into Isabel's face. Then the events of the previous night hit him like a sock full of damp sand. Mort swung his legs out of bed, still wreathed in the remains of his dream.
"Yeah, okay," he said. "I'll go see him directly."
"He's not here. Albert's going crazy." Isabel stood by the bed, tugging a handkerchief between her hands. "Mort, do you think something has happened to him?" He gave her a blank look.
"Don't be bloody stupid," he said. "He's deaf."
He scratched his skin. He felt hot and dry and itchy.
"But he's never been away this long, not even when there was that big plague in Pseudopolis. I mean, he has to be here in the mornings to do the books and work out the nodes and..."
Mort grabbed her arms.
All right,"
he said, as soothingly as he could manage. "I'm sure everything's okay. Just settle down, I'll go and check. Why have you got your eyes shut?"
"Mort, please put some clothes on," said Isabel in a tight little voice.
Mort looked down.
"Sorry," he said meekly, "I didn't realise. Who put me to bed?"
"I did," she said. "But I looked the other way."
Mort dragged on his breeches, shrugged into his shirt, and hurried out towards Death's study with Isabel on his heels. Albert was in there, jumping from foot to foot like a duck on a griddle. When Mort came in, the look on the old man's face could almost have been gratitude. Mort saw with amazement that there were tears in his eyes.
"His chair hasn't been sat in," Albert whined.
"Sorry, but is that important?" said Mort. "My granddad didn't used to come home for days if he'd had a good sale at the market."
"But he's always here," said Albert, "every morning as long as I've known him, sitting here at his desk, a-working on the nodes. It's his
job. He wouldn't miss it. I expect the nodes can look after themselves for a day or two, said Mort. The drop in temperature told him he was wrong. He looked at their faces. They can't, he said. Both heads shook. If the nodes aren't worked out properly, all the balance is destroyed, said Isabel. Anything could happen.
Didn't he explain? Said Albert.
Not really. I've really only done the practical side. He said he'd tell me about the theoretical stuff later, said Mort. Isabel burst into tears. Albert took Mort's arm, and with considerable dramatic waggling of his eyebrows, indicated that they should have a little talk in the corner. Mort trailed after him reluctantly. The old man rummaged in his pockets and at last produced a battered paper bag.
Peppermint? He inquired.
Mort shook his head.
He never tell you about the nodes, said Albert.
Mort shook his head again. Albert gave his peppermint a suck. It sounded like the plug hole in the bath of God.
How old are you, lad?
Mort. I'm 16.
There's some things a lad ought to be told before he's 16, said Albert, looking over his shoulder at Isabel, who was sobbing in death's chair.
Oh, I know about that. My father told me all about that when he used to take the Thargas to be mated. When a man and a woman...
About the universe is what I meant, said Albert hurriedly. I mean, have you ever thought about it?
I know the disc is carried through space on the backs of four elephants that stand on the shell of Great Artuin, said Mort.
That's just part of it. I meant the whole universe of time and space and life and death and day and night and everything.
Can't say I've ever given it much thought, said Mort.
Ah, you ought. The point is, the nodes are part of it. They stop death from getting out of control, see? Not him, not death, just death itself.
Albert struggled for words.
Like, death should come exactly at the end of life, you see, and not before or after, and the nodes have to be worked out so that the key figures... You're not taking this in, are you?
Sorry?
They've got to be worked out, said Albert flatly, and then the correct lives have got to be got. The hourglasses, you call them. The actual duty is the easy job.
Can you do it?
No.
Can you?
No.
Albert sucked reflectively at his peppermint.
That's the whole world in a gippo, then, he said.
Look, I can't see why you're so worried. I expect he's just got held up somewhere, said Mort, but it sounded feeble even to him. It wasn't as though people buttonholed Death to tell him another story, or clapped him on the back and said things like, "You've got time for a quick half in there, me old mate, no need to rush off home," or invited him to make up a Skittles team and come out for a Clatchian takeaway afterwards, or... It struck Mort with sudden, terrible poignancy that Death must be the loneliest creature in the universe. In the great party of creation, he was always in the kitchen.
"I'm sure I don't know what's come over the Master lately," mumbled Albert. "Out of the chair, my girl, let's have a look at these nodes."
They opened the ledger. They looked at it for a long time. Then Mort said,
"What do all these symbols mean?"
"Sodomy non sapiens," said Albert under his breath.
"What does that mean?"
"Means I'm buggered if I know."
"That was wizard talk, wasn't it?" said Mort.
"You shut up about wizard talk. I don't know anything about wizard talk. You apply your brain to this here."
Mort looked down again at the tracery of lines. It was as if a spider had spun a web on the page, stopping at every junction to make notes. Mort stared until his eyes hurt, waiting for some spark of inspiration. None volunteered.
"Any luck?"
"It's all Clatchian to me," said Mort. "I don't even know whether it should be read upside down or sideways."
"Spiralling from the centre outwards," sniffed Isabel from her seat in the corner. Their heads collided as they both peered at the centre of the page. They stared at her. She shrugged.
"Father taught me how to read the node chart," she said, "when I used to do my sewing in here. He used to read bits out."
"You can help?" said Mort.
"No,"
said Isabel. She blew her nose.
"What do you mean, no?" growled Albert. "This is too important for any flighty..."
"I mean," said Isabel in razor tones, "that I can do them, and you can help."
The Ankh-Morpork Guild of Merchants has taken to hiring large gangs of men with ears like fists and fists like large bags of walnuts whose job it is to re-educate those misguided people who publicly fail to recognise the many attractive points of their fine city. For example, the philosopher Catroaster was found floating face down in the river within hours of uttering the famous line, "When a man is tired of Ankh-Morpork, he is tired of ankle-deep slurry." Therefore, it is prudent to dwell on one, of the very many, of course, on one of the things that makes Ankh-Morpork renowned among the great cities of the multiverse. This is its food. The trade routes of half the disk pass through the city or down its rather sluggish river. More than half the tribes and races of the disk have representatives dwelling within its sprawling acres. In Ankh-Morpork, the cuisines of the world collide. On the menu are 1,000 types of vegetable, 1,500 cheeses, 2,000 spices, 300 types of meat, 200 fowl, 500 different kinds of fish, 100 variations on the theme of pasta, 70 eggs of one kind or another, 50 insects, 30 mollusks, 20 assorted snakes and other reptiles, and something pale brown and warty known as the Clachian migratory bog truffle. Its eating establishments range from the opulent, where the portions are tiny but the plates are silver, to the secretive, where some of the disk's more exotic inhabitants are rumoured to eat anything they can get down their throat best out of three. Harger's House of Ribs, down by the docks, is probably not numbered among the city's leading eateries, catering as it does for the type of beefy clientele that prefers quantity and breaks up the tables if it doesn't get it. They don't go in for the fancy or exotic, but stick to conventional food like flightless bird embryos, minced organs in intestine skins, slices of hog flesh and burnt ground grass seeds dipped in animal fats. Or, as it is known in their patois, egg, sauce and bacon and a fried slice. It was the kind of eating house that didn't need a menu. You just looked at Harger's vest. Still, he had to admit, this new cook seemed to be the business. Harger, an expansive advert for his own high-carbohydrate merchandise, beamed at a room full of satisfied customers. And a fast worker, too. In fact, disconcertingly fast. He rapped on the hatch.
"Double egg, chips, beans and a troll burger, hold the onions," he rasped.
"Right."
The hatch slid up a few seconds later, and two plates were pushed through. Harger shook his head in gratified amazement. It had been like that all evening. The eggs were bright and shiny, the beans glistened like rubies, and the chips were the crisp golden brown of sunburned bodies on expensive beaches. Harger's last cook had turned out chips like little paper bags full of pus. Harger looked around the steamy cafe. No one was watching him. He was going to get to the bottom of this. He rapped on the hatch again.
"Alligator sandwich," he said, "and make it snappy."
The hatch shot up. After a few seconds to pluck up enough courage, Harger peered under the top slice of the long sarnie in front of him. He wasn't saying that it was alligator, and he wasn't saying it wasn't. He knuckled the hatch again.
"Okay," he said, "I'm not complaining. I just want to know how you did it so fast."
"Time is not important."
"You say."
"Right."
Harger decided not to argue.
"Well, you're doing a damn fine job in there, boy," he said.
"What is it called when you feel warm and content and wish things would stay that way?"
"I guess you'd call it happiness," said Harger.
Inside the tiny cramped kitchen, strata'd with the grease of decades, death spun and whirled, chopping, slicing and flying, his skillet flashed through the fetid steam. He'd opened the door to the cold night air, and a dozen neighbourhood cats had strolled in, attracted by the bowls of milk and meat, some of Harger's best, if he'd known, that had been strategically placed around the floor. Occasionally Death would pause in his work and scratch one of them behind the ears.
"Happiness," he said, and puzzled at the sound of his own voice.